Hello, and welcome to the latest Strand Group podcast. I'm your host, Martin Stolliday. Today, we're going to be discussing all things London. British government isn't just the gilded palaces of Whitehall. We're going to try and understand how the governance of London works. How can London thrive in the post-COVID world? Today, listener, we're joined by Dr. Nick Bowes, who is Chief Executive for the Centre for London. He was recently the Mayoral Director of Policy at the Greater London Authority, working for Sadiq Khan. Also joining us is Dr. Jack Brown, part of the Strand Group team. Jack is the lecturer in London Studies and leads a module on the history of governance of London at KCL. He's been research in residence at No. 10 Downing Street and research manager at the Centre for London. He did a PhD thesis on the London Docklands Development Corporation under Reg Ward and the emergence of Canary Wharf. And he's also published books on London and No. 10 Downing Street. In this show, we'll also hear from Councillor Elizabeth Campbell, the leader of the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea Council and lead for business, economy and culture at London Councils, to discuss the governance of London from the perspective of the boroughs. Jack, Nick, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Very pleased to be here. Thank you for giving the full title of my PhD thesis as well, which is almost as long as the PhD itself.
Well, lest we forget it, Jack. Hey, I mean, it's very important. Jack, I'll start with you. Just in a couple of minutes, nice and easy. How does the governance of London work? How do we get to where we are now? If you could give us a sort of potted history of where we are, you know, start with the Saxons or something and take it up to the present day.
Yeah, you told me, Martin, in advance you were going to ask me to start with the Romans.
I'm going easy on you.
You know, 2,000 years in 2 minutes. I think that's a little bit much. I think, if you don't mind, I will start in the 1800s. So we'll go a bit geeky and a little bit far back. But I think this is the point where a relatively unplanned city, a kind of organically evolving series of distinct places, little parishes, the City of London, a great financial centre, Westminster, a great centre of political power, first through religion, then through kings and queens, then through politicians. These things kind of emerge relatively independently of one another. And London is basically a series of villages. It's an increasingly built-up area, but governed in distinct small units in a kind of chaotic way until the 1800s, when at the beginning of the 1800s, London gets more than 1 million people. It's growing massively. It becomes the greatest city in terms of population size in Europe and then that the world has ever seen, all within the 1800s. So it's massive explosion of population. With that comes great challenges, particularly of public health. You know, you have repeated cholera epidemics, sanitation, things like that are really hard to do at a very, very local level. And you need more coordination. So in 1855, you get the first attempt at a London-wide government, something called the Metropolitan Board of Works, most famous for the impressive sewage system that we had built by a guy called Bazalgette, and the embankment of the Thames, big projects like that. And then the sort of the long history, it gets rearranged and changed repeatedly. You have something called the London County Council in 1889, the Greater London Council in 1965. But you have a general principle that there's a local sort of boroughs that will run a certain area of London and deal with local services. But you also have like a London-wide government of some nature that sees to sort of strategic issues, those sort of problems that can't be dealt with by local area alone. Most obvious example is transport, right? You know, London is a series of villages, but there's a lot of commuting. There's kind of economically interdependent areas. So you need a strategic body that looks after those things that have to be done at kind of above borough level. This exists and it changes due to reasons of politics and the expansion of London's just sort of physical boundaries. It exists in different formats all the way up to 1986. When partly for political reasons and partly because she's very keen on sort of streamlining local government, Thatcher completely abolishes the Greater London Council, the London-wide government of the time. She leaves the boroughs and the City of London, which is like a borough, it's a local authority, but it's a little bit different. She leaves them alone to continue to exist in, and we still have them today, but there is no London-wide government from 1986 to 2000. There's no voice for the capital. There's no one locally directly elected who is responsible for those kind of strategic citywide issues or for going abroad and promoting London. All of those functions are kind of taken back into central government. They're all fragmented until we get a change in government, 1997, Tony Blair's New Labour, elected with a pledge to restore that London-wide voice for the capital. Blair, I think in particular, is really attracted to the idea of a mayoralty because it's going to be, it's a bit American, but it's also not kind of a traditional sort of local government structure like a council. That can go very left-wing. That's what happened in the early 80s. That's why Thatcher abolished it to some extent. So he likes this idea of having a mayor. He hopes that someone from outside of politics will run, someone like a Richard Branson or something. It will be relatively apolitical. Doesn't quite happen. You end up with Ken Livingstone as the first mayor of London in 2000, running as an independent against Labour. But this model was established in 2000 of a mayor, quite a strong mayor, really, relatively speaking, in comparison to the Assembly, which is the other bit of London-wide government, which is there to kind of scrutinise the mayor and kind of a bit like a select committee to some extent, but with the power to block the mayoral budget if the mayor has, you know, in Ken Livingstone's words, if a mayor goes mad. So they're kind of there as a bit of a backstop. And that's a system we've had since the year 2000. We've had three mayors of London since. Ken Livingstone first as an independent, and then as a Labour mayor when he gets readmitted back into the party. He wins two terms. Boris Johnson, current Prime Minister, as a Conservative mayor of London, also wins two terms. And we're on the second term of the Labour mayor, Sadiq Khan, at the moment. I think it's fair to say it's been quite a difficult two terms so far. But perhaps that's the point where I abandon my potting of the history and we come up to the present, right?
Nick, over to you. You worked very closely with the current mayor and now you analyse what's going on for the centre of London. Just so our listeners have an appreciation of this, what's the state of the mayoralty right now? What can the mayor do and what can't the mayor do? And how does it all work?
Ooh, well, I mean, following on from Jack, who, you know, has described the kind of restless governance of London and the kind of ever-changing kind of nature of it. I'm a geographer by background. I won't bore you with my PhD title, but it's not quite as London-focused as Jack's. But I'm fascinated by London's very restless geography, which seems to kind of match the restless governance. It's forever changing. It's gone into decline and then it's recovered. And, you know, just walking around the city, the other day, I was over near Old Street and I was like, I just didn't recognise three or four streets that I was walking around. It just was so different to what it was like, say, 10 years ago. And I think that kind of, you know, the fact that the city just doesn't stand still very long, you know, it kind of fuels a lot of the kind of uncertainty and the kind of almost the instability of a lot of the kind of institutions in the city, because it feels very different to other parts of the country where there's a lot more kind of stability. Populations feel more stable. The politics perhaps doesn't change as much. I think my time in City Hall, there's an enormous amount that the mayor can do, both within the powers, the statutory powers that the mayor's got, as decided by Parliament, but then also as a result of just being the single figurehead for the whole city. I think the latter, the kind of convening power, the bully pulpit of City Hall, is very difficult to quantify, but is very powerful. But going on to the statutory power side first, I mean, one of the things that I used to find slightly kind of frustrating at City Hall was that we used to get an enormous amount of correspondence from Londoners who basically thought the mayor was responsible for everything. Can you sort out my school? Can you sort out my hospital? You know, there's a pothole down the road. This streetlight's not working. And in part, that's a product of the success of the mayoralty in some respects, because the mayor's got such a high profile that they think that the mayor is kind of responsible for everything. But it's also a kind of, I guess, a degree of just how we need to do a lot more on the kind of political education of Londoners so that they know who does what. But the mayor's key powers are obviously around TfL. He's got statutory responsibility for public transport in London, for appointing the board, appointing the chair. And then he has slightly weaker kind of powers over oversight of the Metropolitan Police. He sets the strategy for the police. He decides their budget. He has no operational say, as no politician does in Britain, but he doesn't have any, he doesn't directly appoint or dismiss the commissioner, which I'm sure maybe is an issue that we might come on to later. And then he has additional powers around setting the strategic direction of the city on planning, on environment, on housing, lots of very New Labour things, actually. The original GLA Act lists lots of strategies that the mayor has to produce. So a very New Labour thing. And actually, because they're written into the face of the bill, very difficult for them ever to get changed. I mean, they should have been in secondary legislation, so they could have been amended, because the mayor has to produce a culture and sport strategy. The two are linked together. But in fact, we took legal advice from my time there, and we decided to do them as two separate documents because it didn't really make sense. But setting lots of strategic directions for the city, but actually with very limited powers to enforce or ensure delivery of those, because a lot of the delivery was in the hands of other agencies, mostly local authorities. For instance, the mayor has to produce a waste strategy for the city. Might sound really boring, but you know, where your waste goes really is important. You know, does it go to recycling? Does it go to landfill? At the moment, we've got almost 32 different systems for collecting waste in London. And you know, one borough does recycling this way, another one does food waste. And the mayor has a set a strategy to increase recycling levels, to reduce the amount going to landfill, and that is actually legally binding in some respects for local authorities, but the mayor can't enforce it. So we're in this kind of position where you know, he has to kind of coax and kind of encourage, but can't actually kind of do anything to really get it over the line. So you've got a lot of things that are in this kind of strange kind of phantom zone of kind of accountability and enforcement. It's kind of strange. And I think a lot of that is a mixture of the centre never really wanting to fully let go on things. You know, it's a kind of half-hearted devolution where they still keep their finger in things. Some of it was like new Labour at its best. Some of it was a rearguard action by the local authorities, many of whom were resistant to the creation of the mayoralty. But then I think recently, moving on to the kind of state of things, I think the Sadiq's had a difficult time as mayor. You know, the backdrop has been very challenging. He's had three prime ministers while he's been in City Hall. It's been two general elections. It's very difficult to kind of build a long-term relationship with so much change, and particularly when the focus of Whitehall was for a lot of that time on Brexit and then more recently on the pandemic. I think it's pretty fair to say relations have not been good the last 2 years with the current government. And I think as a result of the financial pressures on TfL, you have started to see some of the devolved powers being eaten away at and being constrained and boxed in and being overridden, actually, as with conditions attached to things. And I think there's been more conflict with the centre. And a lot of the talk that comes out of Whitehall and this government about devolution and levelling up and more power to communities, it's all about this new country that we now live in, which is everywhere outside of England, outside of London, which is now like a whole new country, seemingly, because it gets talked about quite a lot. And London's just left off the agenda. I think some of that is about politics, some of both in terms of attitudes towards a Labour city, but also in terms of it's popular outside of London to not be nice to London. And we're really feeling that at the moment, I think.
That's really interesting. Jack, would you like to comment on this idea that what is levelling up? How does it work? And does levelling up other parts of the country mean levelling London down? Is that where we are?
Well, I think Nick's thoughts, particularly in Nick's accent, would be wonderful on this, because you know I have a bit of a kind of visceral emotional reaction to some of the rhetoric around levelling up. The anti-London stuff does kind of grind my gears a little bit. But to answer your question really directly, there's no reason why levelling up has to be at the expense of London whatsoever. There's some quite good stuff in the Levelling Up white paper about how it's not about, and in fact, some of the key Boris Johnson speeches about levelling up were about what it's not about as much as what it is about. And it's not about doing London down, and it's not about harming the capital. It's not about taking things away from the capital to give them to other parts of the country. It's about growing the whole pie, right? It's about increasing, boosting productivity in other areas. And for a long time, you know, I've come to that conclusion and agree with that. It's not a kind of zero sum game, economic growth. You know, you can do it in other places. We have other wonderful cities, and we have really important places of all shapes and sizes across the country that could be doing better without harming London. The worry around levelling up is that this isn't a climate where there's a lot of money about. It hasn't been for some time, but particularly post-pandemic, particularly post-Brexit, there's a whole kind of list of reasons why there isn't a lot of money about. And that if levelling up is your main policy pledge, that maybe the easiest way of doing that is to defund London a little bit, or at least, at very, very least, being very charitable, take your eye off the ball in London a little bit and focus elsewhere, focus resources elsewhere. And that could harm the capital. So, you know, I completely buy into the idea that a much stronger Manchester, for example, would be a great thing for London and for the southeast, because it takes some of the pressure off. You know, housing affordability is one of the biggest issues down here. And that's because so many people come here, you know, and if there were strong rival cities, they would be complementary. That'd be a great thing. The worry is the kind of the slightly more political angle of levelling up, which is more about being seen to do things for the rest of the country and not for London, which in a climate with not much money could mean defunding or deprioritising the capital, which is the only bit of the country at the moment that generates more tax than it receives in public spending. So, you know, you do that and you harm the overall public finances even more, and you limit your ability to level up. That's my potted take on that.
Now, I'm delighted to say that we've been joined by Councillor Elizabeth Campbell, who is the leader of the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea. Absolutely delighted to have Councillor Campbell with us. Before we talk to Councillor Campbell, Jack, could you give me another one of your potted histories, this time on the boroughs and how they shape the governance of London?
Sure, Mark, I will pot it as best I can. I think the first thing to say is that the boroughs, or at least a very sort of hyper-local form of government, is kind of how London government starts, right? It begins as a series of parish councils, normally organised around a church, organised in the 1800s, later on into vestries and district boards. But again, this is before there's something known as London, really. These are distinct places, and London's government is kind of born in these very small settlements that are very close together but don't necessarily interrelate. It's not until later on in the 1800s you get the kind of precursors to the boroughs we get today, the Metropolitan Borough Councils, introduced in the turn of the 20th century. You can still recognise some of these names, places like Battersea and Holborn and St Pancras. You can still see some road signs, you know, that show that these boroughs used to exist, but they were a lot smaller. London's growth was massively underway. And in the 1960s, we have a proper look at what is now Greater London and established the boroughs we have today. So following something called the Herbert Commission, you set up the decision was taken to set up 32 London boroughs plus the City of London. So there's 33 local authorities, City of London a bit special, a bit different, alongside the Greater London Council, which was abolished by Thatcher, as previously mentioned, in 1986. But the boroughs survived. The idea when these boroughs were set up was the boroughs would be the sort of primary unit of London government. So they do most of the service provision. Voters, you know, the things that voters get really exercised about, I will ask the council if this is actually still true, but, you know, bins and potholes, kind of very popular issues on the doorstep, but actually just providing public services. It's the boroughs are incredibly powerful, incredibly important. And in making 32 boroughs, you get a bigger Greater London. You take in some more conservative areas, more Labour voting areas. You have some swing boroughs too. And so you're really sort of reflecting the diversity of this city. And so the boroughs to today still have incredibly diverse kind of range of roles and responsibilities, but they're also very different from one another. They're also very different even within the borough. So the example I always give to students is Camden, just because I like to show them pictures from up the top of Camden, you know, Hampstead Heath, looking very sort of semi-rural, all the way down to the bottom where you're basically in the West End. And that's, you know, whilst every borough is different, every borough does have that sort of level of diversity between just very, very different needs, very different people with very different needs living within those boroughs. So it's a huge job, and one that I'm not envious of, actually. It's obviously a very major responsibility. I've got a lot of respect for the people who are tasked with leading them.
Jack, thank you. And that brings me beautifully on to Councillor Elizabeth Campbell. Councillor Campbell, going on from that, you're a leader of a big borough, quite a diverse borough. What makes Kensington and Chelsea, the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea, so unique, and what are the challenges?
I think what makes it so unique is actually also one of its challenges. And it, you touched on it, it's this wonderful diversity. You know, half our residents weren't born in England. So we have people from all over the world who've come here to make their home here. So that makes it incredibly vibrant, incredibly multicultural. It also means that we just have a huge breadth. And Jack was saying, talking about sort of how diverse we are in other ways, and in the sense that, you know, the average house price in Kensington, Chelsea is £2 million. But at the same time, our wards in the north are amongst the most deprived in the United Kingdom. And we have 6,000 people, or 6,000 households living in with food poverty. So we've got that extraordinary gap between rich and poor, extraordinary inequality, which isn't just in Kensington and Chelsea, it's throughout London.
And I guess, Councillor Campbell, that's also something that's slightly unique to London as a city. Other great world cities are more segregated in terms of poorer areas and wealthier areas, but it's something that has uniquely grown up in London.
Yeah, and I think that's our great strength, actually. We're all neighbours, aren't we? We're all friends. If you look out for your own friends and neighbours, if you know people at the end of the street, you know, if you shunt people all off into, like in Paris, into the banlieue, then I think you have problems because you don't have this cohesiveness that we still manage to maintain in London.
Thank you. And you've been a councillor in the borough, I think, since 2006, yeah. But were elected leader in 2017. Is that right? Have I got my dates right?
Yes.
And obviously, when you became leader, there was a huge national focus on the borough in response to the tragic events at the Grenfell Tower. Obviously, there's a public inquiry going on, and you can't see anything that would prejudge that, but could you give us an update on where we are now with that? Now it's fallen out of the national focus slightly, and what in general, what sort of general lessons have been learned about housing in London and some of the other issues around that tragedy?
Well, I think it might have been out of the national focus, but it's certainly in our focus because we've got the 5th year anniversary coming up in June, and so obviously all those who've been bereaved or who've survived or the local community, it's a really tricky time for them as we approach that anniversary. And as the inquiry is going on, I can't really touch on that. All I can say is, as a council, we have absolutely signed up to be completely honest and to approach all questions that we're asked in the inquiry with total candor, because we do believe that the lessons that are learned need to be spread across the whole country. So we're not being at all defensive. We've actually looked at everything and said, okay, well, what could we have done? What should we have done? Is there any way in retrospect we could have done better? That's the way we've approached it. And I think the other thing is we've had just produced an impact report of everything that we've done over the last 4 years to help bereaved survivors and the general community. And now we're trying to say, well, okay, how does this work going forward? What is the legacy? And we've been very lucky, and in that the bereaved and survivors have been unbelievably generous of spirit. So rather than looking at us as a council and saying, right, we want to destroy you, they don't. They turn around to me and say, okay, we want you to be the best. If there's any lesson coming from Grenfell, It's that you should be the best that you should be. And how do we get there? And that's our next, I think that's our next step, to look at the legacy. What legacy will this leave? Will it be a bitter, terrible place to live, or will it be an even better place to live? Because all those 72 people can't have died in vain.
Very, very powerful answer. Can I move the conversation on slightly, but stay on the topic of housing? I think just the point that you made, Councillor Campbell, about average house price in Kensington and Chelsea. It's incredible. You know, £2 million is an insane average. I guess this is pushed up by the top being particularly high, right? Some very, very expensive properties, but also some that are not quite at the £2 million mark. What can the boroughs be doing about this housing situation? It's an incredibly difficult and pertinent one across London. Shortage of housing, quality of housing. What are the kind of tools in your toolkit?
Well, we certainly in Kensington Chelsea are building as much as we can. So we've said, you know, we're going to build 600 homes, of which half are properly social housing. So not affordable, et cetera. Properly 8 people able to afford to live in them. It is difficult because, of course, we're a very crowded city and everyone's cheek by jowl. And people like their conservation areas and beautiful places, and they don't necessarily want tall tower blocks. So I guess like everywhere else in the country, it's difficult. The planning regime makes it hard for us because most residents don't want to have, they don't want to see change. There's a small C conservatism, I'd say, throughout London. Though in the East, I think they've been able to build more than we have in the West. But you know, 75% of Kensington Chelsea's conservation areas, so we can't build in it anyway, which means the pockets of land we've got left are few and far between.
That's something that's very unusual, right? The conservation area dominates nearly the entire borough.
It's nearly the entire borough. And what we try and say is, on the places we are going to build, we want to build the conservation areas of the future. Things can be a bit higher as long as they're beautifully built. I think the design and the look of the place and the feel and the neighbourhood makes a huge difference.
Councillor Campbell, do you have the powers that you want as a borough? Is there anything that you would like devolved down from Whitehall or devolved down from the mayoralty or even upwards? What would make your life easier as a borough in terms of powers?
I think one of the things we're always saying to central government at the moment, it's the powers of sort of helping with employment and skills, because there seems to be a huge disconnect. So for example, at the moment, there's UK Shared Prosperity Fund, which will take over from the European funds. So we don't know how much London as a whole is getting, but we should know that tomorrow. But the amount that we do get, we've been told that we need to focus it on communities in place, or I think it's pride in place is the thing. But we used to spend 70% of the European funds on employment skills. So we need that flexibility because, for example, we're saying London needs to get its tourist trade back. We need, you know, we had 1.6 million visitors a year. But our hotels and our hospitality and, you know, cafes and pubs and restaurants don't have very much many staff. So we don't want to get visitors back here if we can't offer them the service. But in order to get the staff, we need to train people. So we desperately need to put money into skills and training. And at a borough level, we probably understand best what skills people need for what. And I'll give you one example. For example, with all the apprenticeship schemes and things like that the government did a great job in doing, but we didn't have the data. So we couldn't say how many people in Kensington and Chelsea and their names or whatever were coming up to the end of their apprenticeship or were unemployed. So we could cross match and say, okay, if you are that, come to our care fair next week, come to our employers forum. We've got loads of people who are looking for employees. For example, we had a hospitality forum the other day. We had 400 offers, 400 people saying, sorry, not 400 people, 400 offers of work, and people saying that could sign on bonuses, but we need to get the people to come to the fair. So I do think employment and skills can certainly be done at a borough level, if not, you know, a sub-regional level as well, but it doesn't make sense for that to be done centrally.
just staying on the sort of who has power for what, we've been chatting to Nick Bowes about the mayoralty and the strategic direction that the mayor has. How do you find that your relationship as a borough is with that wider overarching London strategies from the mayor's level?
Well, I think it's quite complicated, actually. So if you take things like bike lanes, for example, obviously at a strategic level for the mayor, they want to have bike lanes crisscrossing all the boroughs, etc., which is fine, and it's a really good thing to do. But if you look at our borough, we're sort of skinny, tall and skinny. So there's like a kilometre and a half across where the mayor would like to have a segregated bike lane. But unfortunately, that's Kensington High Street, which is, you know, a street laid out in the, I don't know, 19th century. And we're trying to look at how we revive our high streets, and our residents who live all about don't necessarily want a very fast cycle superhighway coming straight through their residential shopping area. So that's a bit of a balance, isn't it? Because my job is to represent my residents. Mayor's job is to represent a strategic look for London. I'm going into elections. Of course, I'm going to listen to my residents and my businesses, because we know at a hyper-local level what will work. But I think that gives you an example of some of the conundrums that we face.
Can I quickly add one there? I'm sorry, I'm grilling you as well. But what are the things going into the elections? What are the things that people are saying, residents are saying that they're concerned about? Bike lanes, I'm sure, very important, but I'm sure there's a big list.
Yeah. Actually, in my borough, bike lanes don't feature very highly. It's the real sort of stuff that, you know, when you come out of your front door, so, you know, clean streets, that makes a huge difference. And actually, over COVID, I think people noticed them even more, because when they did get to go out, they really appreciated our wonderful bin men coming to clean the streets and the street sweepers, etc. Parks, very important. Again, after COVID, you know, we all crammed into the parks, didn't we? And everyone really appreciates them more than they did, I think. What else? Things like single parking permits for us, that you can park anywhere in Kensington and Chelsea. So really, really local stuff, which actually makes an enormous difference to your quality of life. Excellent schools, you know, we have 95% of our schools are good or outstanding. That makes an enormous difference. So I think of it as, when you wake up in the morning, the first thing you do on your way to the tube or on the way to work, what do you see? Are your streets clean? Are the great big potholes in the road? And you notice, actually, if you come from K&C across to any of our neighbouring boroughs, that they have many more potholes. So if you're a cyclist, at least you won't sort of die by sort of falling, going head over heels into an enormous pothole that other boroughs to the west of us have.
There we go. If you're gonna fall down a massive pothole, you're not going to do it in Kensington and Chelsea.
Exactly. You're not going to go down a steep hole in Kensington and Chelsea.
Just touching a little bit on that, another part of your role is as the executive member for business, economy and culture on London councils. And in that, with that sort of hat on, if you like, maybe you could touch on how the capital responds to COVID, getting businesses up and running again, getting things going in this post-COVID era. Are you confident that the city, especially sort of the central shopping and business and leisure areas, can come back in the same way?
Yes, but they've really suffered. I mean, the central economic zone, the central activity zone, I should say, has really, really suffered. And their numbers of their footfall isn't back up yet. And it's basically two things. It's one is the tourism, which I mentioned before. You know, 1.6 million visitors coming to spend lots of money, no longer here. And then also it's this hybrid working, and we're really missing the footfall of workers who come in. You know, you come in on the tube, you pick up your coffee, you have lunch, then in the evening you might meet friends for a drink, go to the theatre. So we're missing both those sides to part of the visitor economy. Am I sure it'll bounce back? Yeah, I really think so. I mean, London is such a beautiful place, isn't it? And it's different from, I don't know, New York, Hong Kong, Paris, because it's got this amazing mixture of really modern and really old. And it's got a nightlife like nowhere else. And it's got this incredible culture of theatres and cinemas and wacky things going on and art galleries. And it's just the, you know, the most wonderful place on earth, I think, to live. And I think it will bounce back. But at the moment, we're suffering. And that's why we're saying to government, you know, don't overlook us. When they're looking at inequalities, they're looking at inequalities between regions, whereas we are saying to them, well, hold on a second, how about looking about inequalities within regions? And, you know, we have twice as many people on unemployment benefits, related benefits, I should say, in London, than there are in Birmingham, Manchester, Liverpool, Bristol, Nottingham and Sheffield put together. So I think, you know, look at the people, don't look at the place sometimes. Don't get misled by the fact that all London streets are paved by gold. You know, they're not. And we have pockets of huge deprivation. And if we're looking at inequalities, we should be looking at inequalities within London and not just between, you know, us and the regions. And I'll give you one other, example, because I always think this really shows it, okay? The Levelling Up funds so far. So they had a community renewal fund, right? And London got 42 pence per resident. And in Wales, they got £14.83 per resident. So I rest my case. So I'm hoping that tomorrow that London will see a fair allocation of resources.
Sense from what you say, Councillor Campbell, you're worried that levelling up means levelling down for your area.
I just think that levelling up has to affect everyone. And, you know, before the pandemic, I think we're very proud to be Londoners and we're really proud to contribute to the rest of the economy. And we don't really see ourselves, you know, people say, oh, you know, oh, London was a goose which lays the golden eggs. I don't see it like that at all. I see it as this complete partnership. You know, for everyone who spends a pound in London, that's 24p's worth of production generated elsewhere. You know, we're the capital city. We're proud to be British. We're proud to have sell, I don't know, Scotch whiskey or handbags or shoes or mulberry, whatever it is. We're the shopfront for the rest of the UK. We love that. And what benefits London benefits the rest of the United Kingdom. And, you know, we go in partnership and we're all part of the same puzzle. But in order for us to be part of that, to help generate wealth across the UK, to continue that, we might need a bit of help now because, you know, our unemployment figures are higher than the rest of the country. Our people on benefit and poverty are higher than the rest of the country. And it's very easy to gloss over things with just percentages. It's just the numbers. You know, we're the biggest city, 12 million people. We're just, our problems are on a different scale.
Councillor Campbell, you're known as being a very effective person at sort of getting into Whitehall and advocating what you want from them and what you need to get from them. Is there any one thing that you would really help your borough? We used to talk about Crossrail 2. Do you remember that? The Hackney Chelsea line. Are there any sort of grand projet that you've got your eyes on next time you see Grant Shapps?
Well, yes, I'm very glad you've asked this. As it happens, South Kensington, we have a tube station in South Kensington, which has more, well, I shouldn't say has now, but pre-pandemic, and we hope to be there in a couple of years, so this is a great time to start building, has had more customers, passengers passing through it than Terminal 5 at Heathrow, but it doesn't have any step three access. So we've got the greatest museums in the world. You know, we've got the Science Museum, the Natural History Museum, the V&A, we've got the Royal Albert Hall. But if you're bringing your child in a pram and you come by tube, number one, it's unbelievably overcrowded. You'd be lucky if you can get squashed into the tube and come out alive. And secondly, you can't get up the steps. Or if you come in a wheelchair, you can't get up the steps. It's completely bonkers. Nowhere else would you just have this sort of infrastructure sort of void in the middle of a really important tourist area. So for residents...
I've carried a pram up those steps myself.
Have you? There you go.
I have. It's a nightmare. I mean, it really, it's not fit for purpose, is it?
No. But to be fair, I'm not sure it's asking Grant Shapps, so maybe asking TfL and the mayor. And I'm certainly not going to get in the argument between the government and the mayor over TfL.
There's plenty of arguments going on already about that, right? There's no, it's overcrowded, just like South Kensington.
I'm nodding in for South Kensington because I think we really need it. And, you know, it's an iconic part of London, and it would be well served if we had a proper tube station there.
Absolutely. Because the street layout is much better now, isn't it, when you come out of the tube?
Yeah, because we've done a lot.
That's really good. Stuff.
So we're really, you know, we always say that we're Paris's, you know, 14th or 28th, whatever it is, a rendezvous. Don't go to Paris. You can stay in Chelsea. Because guess what? We've got street cafe culture here too. And we've shut roads and we've got little summertime terraces. And we're going to have summertime in Sloane Square with lots of... So you don't need to go abroad. Stay here and enjoy continental cafe culture.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your time, Councillor Campbell. Really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you. There's one area, Nick, isn't there, that of London that needs quite a bit of money at the moment, and one area where central government and the mayoral tea are locked in an ongoing state of conflict, and that's over transport for London with these kind of rolling bailouts, if you like, to keep the system working and the system going. Can you just describe the overall picture of that conflict? What do central government want? What does TfL need? And where are we on that?
Wow. Okay. So I think that kind of almost needs its own podcast series, actually. I mean, I think the starting point on this is that TfL has been one of the real successes of the mayoralty. You know, we've created the world-class public or transport authority in London that is admired across the world. And as Westminster politicians regularly do, is what the rest of the country is now aspiring to with this London-style transport. It is an enormous organisation. It has a budget which is in excess of, I think, half of all Westminster government departments. Employs, you know, tens of thousands of people. I think it's 48,000 people in total. And it has is overhauled London's transport network. I've lived here the whole length of the time TfL's existed. I moved here in summer 2000, just as the mayoralty was created. I remember what the tube was like. I remember what the bus network was like. And it has been transformed. And I think the Roundel is probably one of the most trusted brands and symbols in the city, as well as being one of the most recognisable. So that's kind of where we're up to. And that has come about through a lot of investment from central government, capital investment, mostly over the years, as an acknowledgement that there was an enormous amount of work to do to repair decades of underinvestment. But also the city was growing. There's 2 million more people live in London than when TfL was first created. So you've had to increase capacity to cope with that. And actually, until recently, most of the money was spent on just upgrading the old system. I mean, some additions like the overground, but it was mostly about actually repairing a decaying system. Crossrail's probably the one big example of where there's a big additional capacity. What happened about 10 years ago was that previously about £1 billion a year came to TfL from central government that went towards was revenue support, i.e. it went towards the running costs of TfL. It wasn't for capital expenditure, it was for to help basically to keep the fares where they were, essentially. The fares are already one of the highest, I think, in Europe. But that was agreed between the previous mayor and George Osborne at the time, that as part of the austerity drive, that would be tapered off to zero over a couple of years. So by the time the pandemic came, TfL was basically having to wash its own face with its own income. And it was managing to do that. It was very close to doing that and would have achieved that if it wasn't for the pandemic. So essentially it was paying for itself through fares and other income. It was almost 70% reliant on fares. Pandemic comes along. In the first wave in particular, everybody's told to get off public transport, but we had to carry on running it as a city. So suddenly you've lost all that income, but your outgoings are still the same. That left a massive hole in the budget, and they ate into their reserves very quickly and needed government support. And I think it's nearly £5 billion that's been provided now over the last 2 years. But I think any organised, and the National Rail Network had exactly the same problem. I think the issue that it then brought out into the fore was that the politics got into that. There was a mayoral election in the during the pandemic, so it became a kind of a bit of a political football, accusations about finance has not been in a good enough state, et cetera, et cetera. And then the conditions have been attached to the bailouts, and every bailout seems to go right to the wire. I mean, I know from when I was at City Hall, one was 10 minutes to midnight on a Sunday night, 10 minutes until TfL would have run out of money. And I think they've all been so really close to the wire like that. And we've had the week extension here, 2 weeks there, a bit more money from government. I mean, it must be causing enormous stress and being very destabilizing for the organization. They can't do any forward planning because they've not got any certainty around budget. Now, the question, I guess, is, can you run a public transport network in a big global city like London without some form of subsidy from central government? Well, most other cities can't. London was the exception. It was managing it, but it was overly exposed on fares. And I think that is going to be the big debate over the next couple of years about whether there needs to be either more money coming from central government to restore some of that grant that was cut, or does the mayor find other ways of generating income to fill that gap? Or does TfL have to shrink, cut services so that it can live within its means? And I think that's where we are at the moment, really. And then, you know, just to make it even more complicated, we don't really know whether we're going to recover back to the same passenger level numbers that we had before the pandemic. I'm guessing probably not. And even a modest reduction in the numbers of people using the tube every day over a year is a big drop in income for TfL. And that's less money for them to spend on upgrades, buses, tubes, etc. Again, that will have ramifications for the network.
Finally, we've touched on this earlier in the podcast, but I think it's really well worth saying. The big sort of story recently involving the mayor was the dismissal of Cressida Dick as the Met Commissioner. I think a lot of people looking at that would say that the Mayor of London has sacked the Met Commissioner. That's not quite what's happened there. What are the powers of the mayor in relation to the police?
The GLC didn't have any responsibility for policing, any formal responsibility. But when the mayoralty was created, the decision was that it would do, because that was an anomaly. But I think the original plan was that the mayor would be solely accountable for the Met Police and would be in charge of appointing slash dismissing the commissioner. But as the legislation was going through in the late 1990s, there was a rearguard action by the Home Office who didn't like the fact that this was being wrestled away from them. And they won that battle, actually. And instead, the Met Police remained, I think, slightly more accountable to the Home Office than they did to the mayor. Their reasoning was that the Met Police is not just London's police. It actually has a number of national functions, such as counter-terrorism, and the Met Police Commissioner is the de facto kind of head of Britain's police. Now, whether the national functions are part of the Met on purpose so that the Home Office retains involvement in the Met Police, or whether it's the other way around, I'm not sure. I mean, I've always been a bit suspicious that there are national policing agencies, there's a national crime agency, so you could move national functions out of the Met Police so that it just police London, and then you would remove the reasons for the Home Office still having a say. The legislation around the appointment of the commissioner says that the Home Secretary has to have regard to what the mayor recommends, but you know, the interpretation of that is that the Home Secretary could just totally ignore what the mayor recommended. They would have to explain publicly why. We've never had that situation because the the occasions where a new commissioner has been appointed. I mean, it is also just worth remembering, of the last five commissioners, four have resigned and the fifth left early. It's not been a massively great end to a number of commissioners' careers, but on each occasion, the rules and legislation has kind of worked, because I think the Home Secretary and the Mayor have realised they've just got to make it work. But that did rely on the personalities and the people, and you may have a scenario at some point where that doesn't happen, and you could have a Home Secretary that thinks, I don't care what the Mayor says, I'm going to impose a Met Commissioner on him or her, and they can just lump it. And I think that would be tricky for all sorts of reasons. The Mayor is the de facto Police and Crime Commissioner for London. In every other region in England and Wales, they have a Police and Crime Commissioner who appoints and or dismisses their commissioner. The Mayor is the only Police and Crime Commissioner that doesn't have that power. It is an anomaly. It should be tidied up. But I think this also goes further. I think there needs to be much deeper reform of the Met Police, and just who the commissioner is and how they're appointed is not going to solve some of the really deep problems and the terrible decline in confidence that there's been over the last 3 or 4 years in the Met Police as a result of a whole number of scandals. And I think it feels like there's an opportunity to reform more than just how the commissioner's appointed.
Yeah, it's something that needs a lot of careful thought, isn't it? And maybe just changing the structure of how London works wouldn't exactly solve all of the problems. Last question to you both. We're obviously in a sort of post COVID environment now. Are we back to business as usual, or has the capital irrevocably changed? And if so, how?
Well, so I've sort of gone on the record quite early as, you know, saying death of the city, not going to happen, which was, I stand by. I think, you know, there are a million reasons why a great city like London, not just London, this applies to many cities, but particularly to London, because of its scale, because of its history. It has a lot of things that appeal to people, that attract people from around the world, from around the country, to come here. And those things are not just having great tube trains that take you to a central London office and back home again. They are local entertainment, nightlife, culture. They are being around all the various reasons you want to be around other people that are not related just to your paycheck. And so even if we're looking at a very different London, and the longer this goes on, the more we've got used to a degree of home working, the more you are thinking, it looks like there is a kind of a change. It's definitely not going to be business as usual. We're not going to go back to mass 5 day a week in the office working in central London almost exclusively, or in intense focus on central London. And so some of those patterns, you know, how many days, the exact physical locations where people will be working, how many people are getting on the tube, something we were talking about earlier, or at least where they're going on the tube, you know, those things might change and might alter. And possibly, I'm quite convinced by the argument that they were already changing before the pandemic, that, you know, more flexible working was happening, high streets were under pressure from Amazon, people weren't going out as much because they've got Netflix at home. So you can exaggerate all these, but like, these are changes that have been massively accelerated. I just don't think it's going to lead to everybody, you know, moving out to go live in Cornwall and work remotely, you know, because it's much nicer and you can live by the beach. There's still a million other reasons to be in a big city like London. Not saying that other lifestyles are not available and are not wonderful, equally wonderful for those who choose them, but so many of the things that make London so great remain. And I do think I am optimistic about recovery. I think there's some relatively good news on tourism recently, which is a huge thing for London, and collapsed alongside people taking the tube for work. You know, we lost a lot of tourism, and that's gradually coming back, and that's a positive. So there's a million other things to make me think we're going to be okay. But perhaps that's because I'm a very optimistic person in general, perhaps to the point of naivety. I think it's still good, and I think we're going to be all right.
Nick, do you share Jack's optimism?
I think I do. And I think I agree with, I think I was in the same place as Jack throughout this kind of crisis, really. I mean, I was always very sceptical of a lot of the kind of voodoo demography that there was in the early waves about how many people have fled the city. You know, 700,000 people have left London. And I was a bit like, well, A, how do they even know that? I mean, what kind of, I mean, there was a lot of dubious kind of calculations. I always thought that wasn't the case. I thought maybe some people have temporarily gone to stay with family outside of London. I know people who did that in the first wave. And then you started to see all these stories in the Daily Mail and the other papers about people, we've left London to buy a bigger house with a garden. And it was like, well, that's always happened. So all you're writing about is a trend that has happened for decades. It's not new. It's happened and it will carry on happening. That conveyor belt of people reaching their early 30s, having a family, realizing they need more space, moving out of London. And I think we've seen over recent months that a lot, it wasn't the case that as many people left as were thought, if any, actually, because I think London's population is probably broadly, I think the GLA published some data the other day which suggested that it might not be going up by as much as it was, but it's still going up. I think Jack's right that what we'll see is some speeded up processes that were already happening about how people live, work and travel, which will have ramifications for the city, because if everybody works at home one day a week who previously went into the office 5 days a week, might not sound like very much, but that's not actually a marginal impact on revenue for, say, TfL. That's quite a lot of money on any one day. It's a lot fewer people buying their lunch in Pret-a-Manger every day, or going out after work for a drink and staying in the centre of town every day, etc. That does start to add up. And I think there will be a transition to what happens in central London. What we've got to be really careful about is that the really kind of dense ecosystem that makes it the fantastic place that it is in the west end of the city doesn't unravel, because everything relies on everything else. You've got hospitality, shops, nightlife, offices, tourism. They're all attracted to very many of the same things and rely on each other. If you pull on one thread, there is a risk that it starts to unravel. So I think there will be a transition. Transitions can be painful, because businesses don't go out of business on a Friday and people all lose their jobs, and then they all suddenly walk into another job on a Monday in a brand new business. Labour markets aren't perfect. You do risk having perhaps empty space. You do risk having perhaps businesses not surviving. And public policymakers are going to have to be fleet of foot to adjust to that. Will it present more opportunities for people to live in the centre? Will we see more space for creative types and small businesses to move in? And what happens with retail space of which we've lost a lot of, particularly on Oxford Street? What does the future of that look like? I think we still don't really know. But go out in the West End on a weekday night or the weekend and it's packed. The big thing is the two rush hours are nowhere near what they were. And I get a seat most days on my commute now, which I didn't previously get for most of the 20 years I lived in London. So I think, you know, I think there'll be change and there'll be transition, but I think the fundamentals are still there and London is still a fantastic city that people from all over the world want to come and visit.
That's wonderful. And couldn't agree more with those comments. I think also that voodoo demography would be a fantastic name for maybe a band or a, you know, maybe a tribute band of geographers or something.
I'm very
like
good
that.
At playing the triangle, but that's probably about it.
Well, I think voodoo demography could be a central London bar that opens up in a disused former office space. There you go. Ties it all together.
Dr. Nick Bowes, Dr. Jack Brown, thank you both so much for joining me on this episode of the podcast. I'm sure our listeners will agree that was a fantastic chat with both of you. Thank you.